Welcome to Explorations in Cosmology. So my name is Matt. You can call me Matt Johnson. My office, should you want to come ask me questions, is number 228. I have an open door, so please, if you do have any questions, feel free to stop by or email me and we can set up a time to chat. And speaking of which, my email address is mjohnson@perimeterinstitute.ca. Feel free to email me with any questions that you might have. Okay, so let's get started. So this is going to be kind of a grab bag course of topics. So I'm going to start off by talking about what I'll call the linear universe. And that's going to have to do basically with seconds to millions of years, if we're talking cosmic time scales. And I hope that by the end of this first unit, which is probably going to be, I don't know, the first 1.5 weeks, you should be able to understand how we interpret the ripples, the lumps and bumps in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and turn that into information about our universe. Okay, so that's the goal of the first part of this course. The second part of this course and third part of this course, I don't think we've quite ironed out the order, but Dan is going to take over for about 3 lectures. Maybe he's going to go number 2. And he's going to tell you about something a little bit more speculative. Eternal inflation, and that's going to be maybe 3 lectures. So this has to do with basically the initial conditions for this period of accelerated expansion inflation that Latham told you about. So he's going to go into some of the issues about that. And then there's going to be a little segment that will be about calculating the inflationary density perturbations. Latham showed you a little bit of this, but we're going to go into a little bit more detail and in particular explain some of the main properties of the inflationary density perturbations, namely, why are they nearly scale invariant, why are they nearly Gaussian, and why are they adiabatic. And here, this is going to be, again, about maybe 3 lectures. And a postdoc here at PI, Paul McFadden, is going to deliver those 3 or so lectures. Okay, so it'll be a bit of a grab bag. This is like really standard stuff that everyone should know. This is cool stuff that I've had requests to talk about, and it's fun. And this is very important if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty details. So anyway, I hope this is an interesting grab bag of topics. Okay, so without further ado, let's start on part one. And maybe I'll just start very broadly, and I'll talk about cosmology and why it's easy or hard. Okay, so there's t less than seconds. Okay, and for my purposes, we're going to call t less than seconds early universe. So early universe, you can characterize the types of things that we need to know about in the early universe. You know, this is like particle physics. I need to understand sort of the interactions that are going on, the stuff that inhabits the early universe before seconds. Why seconds, first of all, I should say. So seconds corresponds roughly to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And that's sort of the earliest time we really have any direct information about. We can go measure the distribution of lithium and helium, and that tells us something about BBN. So this is really like before seconds, that's the boundary of speculative physics. Okay, so before seconds, I really don't know. There's no really direct evidence. Okay, so because it's in this regime, I need to know about particle physics. If I go back really far, say near the Big Bang singularity, I need to know about quantum gravity, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so cool physics, but you can really characterize this. You know, it's sort of speculative, poorly understood. We sort of don't know the initial conditions. So even if I had a set of equations, I wouldn't really know what kind of initial conditions to put in that set of equations. That would also be more or less speculative. But, you know, nevertheless, there are some concrete predictions that might come out of this early universe. And probably the most notable example being the theory of inflation. Okay, so that's one example. And of course, you've probably heard that recently there has been this result, which hints that we've seen primordial gravitational waves, which are a direct prediction of inflation. So that's a perfect example of, you know, this speculative, poorly understood period, nevertheless giving rise to some concrete predictions that we can go out and look for. So this is hard, but not impossible. Okay, so that's early universe, t less than seconds. Those are the kind of things you talk about, the kind of things you need to know. And then there's what I'm going to call late universe. And really, this is just because of my personal interests. So my personal interests kind of lie in the early universe. And now there's the late universe, which I'm also interested in. So late universe, what do I mean by that? So if I go from seconds to maybe millions of years, we'll call that late universe. And so this period here is a period where I actually have direct information about what happened. You know, I can tell you with some degree of certainty what happened. And so the types of physics that I care about in the late universe, you know, it's known stuff. It's stuff that we can get our hands on, like the hydrogen atom. Stuff like general relativity, stuff like, you know, perfect fluids, so fluid mechanics. Things like stat-mech, since I might say I have thermal equilibrium. You know, scattering, so really easy scattering, like Thomson scattering, gamma photons scattering on electrons, things like this. Okay, so you'll note that the late universe is characterized by physics that you probably already know. Okay, so you've probably already seen all of this before. This is sort of, you know, the standard curriculum for a physics major, if you will, right? So this is kind of nice. It's you know, known physics. There's relatively simple evolution, so I can write down a set of equations that I can actually solve. Concrete predictions. And so working out the consequences in the late universe is more or less an exercise in known physics. It might be difficult, but it's definitely doable. And there's one property in particular, which I'll talk about in a second, that makes this really doable, and makes it actually not all that difficult, which is that this period of time you can think of as the linear universe. So what I mean by that is that it's basically nothing, a completely smooth universe with really small things on top. Okay, so I can use perturbation theory. And using perturbation theory, I can understand almost everything that I need to know about this period of time in the universe. So this is really clean, this is really nice. And then if we go 10 to the 6 years, a million years, to billions of years, we'll call this the present universe. So right now we think the universe is 13.8 billion years old. So this is kind of close. This is in the regime of the present universe. So you can see that by present, I mean, you know, plus or minus a lot of years. But that's just my definition. It doesn't mean anything. So what characterizes the present universe? Okay, so the first thing we notice is that we live in a planet, right? So the ambient density of the Earth is way different than the ambient density of empty space. So this idea that I can use linear theory, that it's just a background with small things on top, is obviously totally false. Okay, so it's non-linear. In particular, I have to deal with like non-linear gravitational collapse. So I have to deal with the growth of real structure, like galaxies and stars and planets. The things that come with that, there are like, you know, shock waves, all sorts of terrible non-linear fluid dynamics. And you can think of the present universe, this is like doing astrophysics. Like if I think of the traditional astrophysicists, they specialize in all sorts of these kind of things, you know, like nasty shock waves and nonlinear fluid dynamics and all of this stuff. So it's you know, it's known physics. There's, you know, known evolution, so I know the equations I need to use, right? There's known initial conditions. So I know everything, but this is really hard. Okay, so to figure out what goes on in the present universe, you have to use simulations, you know, that include all this terrible nonlinear physics. You can't really do much with a pencil and paper. You very quickly enter the regime where you just have to throw up your hands and say, it's too complicated. I don't really know what I'm doing without just simulating it. And because it's nonlinear, that makes it really, really difficult because nonlinear systems have extraordinary sensitivity to differences in the initial conditions, right? So let's say I wanted to extrapolate what happened in the solar system, right? And that's really hard. We don't know how the Earth formed. That's a major outstanding question. And to do that, I really need to, you know, simulate the formation of many solar systems and then tune the initial conditions really precisely until I get something that kind of looks like the Earth, say. So this problem here, sort of inferring information about the universe in this nonlinear regime is really hard. So we're going to not focus on the speculative, and we're going to not focus on the really hard, and we're going to do this in-between part, right? Why? It's really important. Most of the information we actually know about our universe comes from this period of time. So this, if you like, has most of the information we know about our universe actually comes from this period of time here. So the very important thing to know. And you might have heard people go on and on about, you know, oh, cosmology, we're in this golden age, and this is exciting time of discovery. And that's really all due to this. Okay, so instead of speculating about what might have happened at the Big Bang and this and that, instead of running super complicated computer simulations and then trying to convince everyone that they're right and we include all the important physics, we can really do precision cosmology with this period of time here. Okay, so anything with a really tiny error bar on it probably comes from over here. Okay, so most of the information about our universe, and then another little box here, this sort of makes precision cosmology possible. So count your lucky stars that there is this period of time that we can describe the universe using linear theory, because if we couldn't, then we'd probably still be debating about the, like, you know, globe of stars pasted to some, you know, thing. We would know very little about the universe. So this is what makes precision cosmology possible. Okay, so what is the theory? Of the late universe. So what do I mean when I say this? Really what I mean is relativistic hydrodynamics and general relativity. That's our theory of the late universe. So what are some of the governing equations of our theory? Okay, so one governing equation would be some description of space-time itself. So I need some description of the geometry. And that, of course, is given by the metric. So the metric in a Robertson-Walker universe, you can write it sort of as follows. Psi. So if I have a flat Robertson-Walker universe, if I get rid of the psi and the phi, then this would just be the FRW metric. But you see, now I've added this two metric function here in front of the d tau squared and here in front of the dx squared. And these are going to be the small deviations from Robertson-Walker. So here, this metric is FRW plus small deviations. What I mean by that is psi and phi, we're going to assume to be much less than 1. Okay. So that's one governing equation that tells me the geometry of space. Of course, as it is, these functions in here, like the scale factor a of tau and these two perturbations, these are just free functions, so I need to know how they behave. And of course, the way that I learn how they behave is to solve Einstein's equations. Okay, so Einstein's equations are just a set of PDEs for the metric. So this is a system of equations that tells me how to solve for what these functions up here are doing. So that's an important thing. Now, Einstein's equations tell me that the geometry is related to what I assume the universe is filled with. So I need to tell you what kind of sources there are. So what are the sources? What fills the universe? So here we assume that basically, for all intents and purposes, the stuff in the universe is well described by a perfect fluid. And a perfect fluid has an energy momentum tensor that looks something like this. Okay, so a perfect fluid is described by a density, pressure, so four velocities, and then in here we've got the metric. Okay, so this is the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid. I'm sure you've seen it before, perhaps in Latham's class. And we're going to allow for there to be multiple species, okay, so multiple kinds of fluids. You know, what kinds of fluids? So photons, visible matter, which we'll refer to as baryons generally, even though I know that not all visible matter are baryons, but you just call it baryons and you lump it all together. Dark matter, perhaps dark energy, and dot, 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 okay? So this is a fairly comprehensive list for the stuff that we think we know inhabits the late universe, at least, okay? So this is the types of fluids we think about. So if it were just these two terms in the energy momentum tensor, it would be a perfect fluid. Of course, the stuff that fills the universe is not exactly a perfect fluid, okay? So we have plus dot, 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 because this stuff isn't really a perfect fluid, but I can encapsulate the imperfections as this dot, dot, dot. So we'll talk about the dot, dot, dot later, but for now, this is what it is. Okay, so I have some sources, right? Now I need to know how these sources behave. So who can tell me the governing equation for how these sources will behave? I need that too, but I need something else. Okay, it's too early. So the equation that I need is conservation, right? I need a concept of conservation of energy. And that's the thing that's going to tell me how these sources behave. So what am I on, number three? So number four, I need a set of conservation laws to tell me how the energy momentum tensor evolves with time. And of course, that conservation law is just given by that. Okay, so the covariant derivative, that's I'm going to use knob law for the covariant derivative acting on the stress energy tensor has to be zero. And from this, that's a differential equation. So I get a set of differential equations that tell me how the density and the pressure and the velocities evolve with time. So that's not enough. There's one other thing I need to close that system of equations, which is the equation of state. So for perfect fluids, I also need the equation of state for each of these different fluids. And that's the quantity that tells me how the pressure is related to the density. Okay, and typically for the known types of fluids, okay, so for example, for matter, W equals zero. for radiation, W equals a third. And for lambda, cosmological constant, W is minus one. That's kind of a laundry list of the most typical things. And you'll notice that in each of these cases, we are also quite fortunate because most of the stuff in the universe is described by a constant equation of state parameter. Makes the equations a little bit easier. Okay, so we've got equations now that tell me how the matter filling the universe behaves. That's given by the conservation laws and the equation of state parameter. And the last thing that we'll need, well, one of the last things we'll need, I guess, is going to be some concept of how the distribution of all these particles behaves. So the, you know, the universe is filled with the radiation and matter, and I kind of treat them like they're a fluid, but really it's a bunch of particles, right? So we need to know sort of something about the particulate nature of this fluid. And that can be expressed in terms of a set of distribution functions. So you might recall that, for example, the density of some fluid in thermal equilibrium or some gas of particles in thermal equilibrium can be written as the following. Okay, so I have this factor here. This is something like degeneracy. So if I have multiple degrees of freedom associated with each particle, like if it had a spin or something, if it had multiple polarizations. This is the energy distribution. So if it was a relativistic particle, then E would just be equal to K, right? So that would be what goes in there. And then this is the thing here. This is the distribution function. And you've seen that before, I assure you. Probably the simplest example would be for bosons. That would just be the Bose-Einstein distribution. So this would be 1 over E to the energy minus the chemical potential over the temperature minus 1. So that's an example of a distribution function. So this tells me that if I have thermal equilibrium, it gives me some understanding about the occupation number and different energy levels, right? So this is something that does tell me about the particulate nature of whatever this fluid is, okay, be it photons or matter or anything else. And the equation, so now I've got a definition, and the equation that governs the evolution of these distribution functions is the Boltzmann equations. And the Boltzmann equations are basically, it's very simple. So if I had no interactions, that would be zero. So it just says the total time derivative of the distribution function is zero. That's with no interactions. But maybe I want to have some interactions, and that's very simple to take into account. I just say that there is a term on the right-hand side, and this incorporates collisions. Like, let's say I had an interaction between my particles. They weren't just totally non-interacting and occupying some distribution function. Okay, so the Boltzmann equations are kind of a restatement of Liouville's theorem, right? That's the phase-based distribution, or the volume, total volume of in phase space doesn't evolve with time. It can change shape, but the total volume can't change with time. And that's the Boltzmann equations, okay? So now I have some quantity and some evolution equation that tell me about this particulate nature of the stuff that fills the universe. And finally, the last thing we need So I've got a set of differential equations, and so those are nice. That's a set of evolution equations that I can apply, but I need to stick in initial conditions, right? So it's meaningless without some set of initial conditions. And so you can think of that something like specifying these quantities in the metric, say phi and psi on some initial time slice. We'll just say that that's time equals zero. And we also need what the distribution of the density is at that initial time. And then the equation of state tells me what the distribution of the pressures is. And then I get the distribution function just by asking, am I in thermal equilibrium? And do I have bosons? Do I have fermions? That's kind of specified by the properties of the particle. Okay. And that's sufficient. So now I have a set of initial conditions. Of course, we need a theory of initial conditions. So you can ask the question, where do these come from? And one answer is this theory called inflation. That's the thing that kind of sets the stage. It gives me the initial conditions for the late universe. Just an aside, that's kind of just putting off your problems, because you could ask, well, I buy myself some time, right? So I say the initial conditions came from inflation, but then you can always ask, why did inflation start in the first place? What were the initial conditions for that? The whole universe, all of physics, is described by one big differential equation, and I always need to stuff in initial conditions. So I can go back earlier in time, but I've still sort of put off this problem. You can ask here, why inflation or something like that. And Dan will answer that question partially. But really, he's just going to put off the problem even earlier. So you can always just kind of, you can forget about your past and put off your problems. They're there. Okay, so we need initial conditions. Okay, so we're done with the course, right? So you now have all of the governing equations that describe the late universe, and I could send you off into a dark room, and using physics that you all know, you could come back and find me in a few months and tell me all about the late universe. So that's it. See ya. Come back. So that's it. Of course, the details are complicated, right? So it's not like I'll just send you home this afternoon and we're done. Okay, so let's work out some of the consequences of this set of ingredients here. And that's more or less what we're going to be doing for the next six lectures. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about the homogeneous universe just briefly. I know you've seen this before in Latham's class, but to set notation and to remind you of some of the most important concepts, we're just going to go through that real quickly. Okay, so what do I mean by the homogeneous universe? Really, I mean, here we have perfect fluids. We've got the Robertson-Walker metric. And the governing equation is going to be conservation of T mu nu. And the Friedman equations. And that's a sufficient set of information to specify the homogeneous universe. So let's remember how that all went. So the Robertson-Walker metric, one way of writing it, is as follows. Okay, so here if we unpack this, so first of all, we've got this thing here. Of course, that's the scale factor. This denotes the metric on a two-sphere. So that piece here is just d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And then I've got this funky factor underneath the R, and that tells me about the whether or not the universe is closed, open, or flat. So for kappa less than zero, we have a universe that's got hyperbolic geometry, it's open. For kappa equals zero, we have a flat universe, and for kappa greater than zero, we have a closed universe. And we think, to very good approximation, that our universe is flat. We might go into reasons, some of the reasons why we think that. But for now, and for most of what follows, we're probably going to be focusing on the flat case. So we will most likely be setting kappa to zero. Okay. So now, what about the coordinates? How do I physically interpret the coordinates? So in a Robertson-Walker universe, if I stick myself at a given position x, I don't go anywhere. Okay. So in this set of coordinates, I just would stay at a constant position. And t is just the proper time along one of these world lines. Okay. So t is just like the proper time along one of these world lines. I can look at a separation. So these are co-moving coordinates. What does that mean? So it means that if I look at the separation between any of these two world lines, the physical distance, or the proper distance, is just the scale factor times this co-moving separation, right? So I've divided out by the expansion of the universe, and that's why on this plot of different world lines in x as a function of t, it's really boring, because all the information about the expansion of the universe has been factored out. Okay, so those are our coordinates. That is the metric. A convenient thing to do is actually to define another time variable. Okay, so here, if we were to calculate the, okay, so first of all, it's flat. So what does that mean? That means we're probably going to be writing the metric as just dt squared. And then, you know, I could choose to write this in, in terms of some Cartesian coordinates, right? So when I say dx vector squared, that's going to be shorthand for dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, or it might mean dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. That's just shorthand for the flat metric, flat Euclidean 3 space. Okay, so it's flat, and I could look at null geodesics. Of course, that's given by ds squared equals zero, and here what we find is that dt over a is equal to dx. So I could integrate both sides, and I'd get my set of null geodesics, and in general, they would be some complicated function, right? So depending on how a depends on time, then this would be some complicated function. So a nice convenient thing to do is to define a new variable where null geodesics have a particularly simple form. So we can simplify these null geodesics by defining the so-called conformal time. Okay, so the conformal time is defined tau as precisely that integral I did above. So this is just given by the integral of t of 1 over a over time. And so if I use that definition, then of course dt squared is just a squared d tau squared. And so that implies that the metric I have above, that flat metric, I can now rewrite it as this. Okay, so it's just the scale factor multiplied by Minkowski space. So why did I call this conformal time? Whenever I have a function that multiplies the entire metric, I call it a conformal factor, and that's why I call this thing the conformal time. So I have this thing that now sits out front of the metric, and now if I ask about null geodesics, ds squared equals 0 gives me that d tau equals dx, and therefore all null geodesics are going to have the equation if say they were moving in the x direction, tau is just plus minus x and a constant, okay? So null rays travel on 45 degree lines. And this is particularly convenient because now I can sort of slice and dice my space-time up into causally distinct regions, right? Because the light cones are what tell me about causality in a metric. Okay, so let's say now I were to draw a plot of tau versus x, and let's call this line here tau equals 0. I could take one of these world lines, and I know at a particular tau naught how to draw the past light cone. It's just a line tau equals negative x plus tau naught. So that's pretty easy. And so on this diagram, I have, for this point now, anything that happens in here can affect that point. Anything that happens out here can't. And so the size of this light cone has a name. So delta x here, which is just, you can think of the elapsed proper time, or the integral dt over a. This is the particle horizon. And it's just the elapsed conformal time. Okay, so the size of this bottom half of the triangle is just going to be tau naught, or twice tau naught, but we call that the particle horizon. And this is the thing that tells me the size of causally connected regions. And it can be very different. Okay, so we'll do two examples just to recap. So if I had a radiation-dominated universe, you'll remember, or take my word for it for right now, we'll talk about the Friedmann equation in a second, that the scale factor is proportional to t to the power 1/2. So we can solve for the conformal time, tau. That's just the integral dt over t to the half, or more precisely, it's proportional to that. Okay, so that means that tau is going to be proportional to t to the 1/2, forgetting about all of the factors of 2 and whatnot. So now I could plug that back into the metric, and of course that implies that A of tau goes like tau. Okay, so in a universe that is dominated by radiation, the scale factor increases like proper time to the 1/2 power or conformal time to the 1 power. Okay, so what else do we learn? We learned something about the range that the conformal time can go. So t goes from 0 to infinity. And here you can see just from this relation that tau has to go from 0 to infinity. And so now I can ask about the behavior of light cones, the behavior of causally connected or separate regions in a radiation-dominated universe. Okay, so tau of 0, that's the x-axis, and this is tau equals 0. That's, of course, what we call the Big Bang. So when tau goes to 0, the scale factor goes to 0. That's the place we call the Big Bang. And now I can consider, let's say, two observers. And at some time here, we could draw their past light cones. And you can see that at an early time near the Big Bang, these light cones don't overlap, right? So this is a picture, a visualization of the fact that you should really think about the Big Bang not as a place, but as a time, right? So I have causally distinct regions even at the time of the Big Bang. It's not like it's a ball that's arbitrarily small and everything can communicate. It really is like I have potentially infinite hypersurface, right? I have all these different causally separate regions. And then as time goes on, let's look at some later time. Now there's some overlap, right? So if I wait long enough, now these two regions are not totally causally separate. They overlap a little bit. And furthermore, in a radiation-dominated universe, I can send a signal from this guy to that one always. You know, I could send a signal out now in a radiation-dominated universe to some distant galaxy, and it might take a long time, but eventually it gets there. So everything is causally connected in a radiation-dominated universe, or everything becomes causally connected eventually. Never figure this thing out. Not on the first day anyways. Sorry, I'll try and bring it back. No, I don't want it all the way at the bottom. Maybe I want that one. Okay, good enough. Okay, so example two would be a lambda dominated universe, aka De Sitter space. That's a universe that just has a cosmological constant and nothing else. And we can go through a similar exercise as we did above. So in a lambda dominated universe, the scale factor is proportional to e to the ht. It's exponential increase, exponential expansion. I'm sure you've heard that before. And so we can calculate tau. Tau is the integral dt e to the minus ht, which of course is proportional to negative e to the minus ht. So I can stick that back in the scale factor, and what do I learn? I learn that the scale factor is proportional to negative 1 over tau. So instead of exponential expansion, well, it's still exponential expansion secretly, but in terms of conformal time, it looks like it just goes like 1 over tau. And now let's ask again about the range. So the range here for t goes from negative infinity to infinity. When t goes to negative infinity, a goes to 0. That's like the Big Bang. When t goes to infinity, a gets arbitrarily big. And now we can ask what happens with tau. So you can see I've got this negative sign in the scale factor. So for the scale factor to go to 0, I need tau to go to negative infinity, right? But the upper limit's a bit funny because to get rid of that negative sign in the scale factor, tau always has to be negative. So that means that to get the scale factor to diverge, tau needs to go to 0. We'll call it 0 minus, because tau is always going to be negative. OK, so I have this now. This is my range that tau can undergo. So let's try and make a similar plot. So now one difference is that the Big Bang doesn't happen at tau equals 0. The Big Bang actually happens at tau goes to minus infinity. But let's call this tau, and this will be tau equals 0 down here. Tau goes to minus infinity, and that's the x-axis. So now it's like the Big Bang is reversed, right? So now the Big Bang is on top. So if I drew that diagram, but I was before the Big Bang, then that's what I'd have. But forget about the physical meaning of that. That makes no sense. So here I have future infinity. This is like where I go if I wait an arbitrarily long time. And the point is that just like the Big Bang was in the Robertson-Walker, future infinity is space-like. So I have this huge hypersurface that represents future infinity, and that's totally space-like. So what does that mean? That means if I have two points that are separated by an arbitrary distance, and I trace their past light cone back. Again, the past light cones are just these 45-degree lines, nothing else. If I go back far enough, they're always causally connected, right? But this guy in the future becomes causally disconnected, right? I can't send information from one point to the other because this is already the infinite future. It doesn't make sense for me to draw null rays that go up here on the diagram. It just ends. Okay, so eventually things become causally separate eventually. So here I might be able to send information from the past, but once I receive it, I can't tell you that I got it. Right? Can't happen. And that's a manifestation of the fact that there are event horizons or causal boundaries in a De Sitter space. So if I stray too far, I can never come back. So that's the power of thinking about things in terms of conformal time, is that I can draw these pictures and I can immediately tell you something about the structure of the space-time. I can tell you something about the causal structure. And that's very nice. And it will be very useful. Okay, so moving right along, I've got about 5 minutes left. Okay, so let's go back to FRW and its evolution. So in particular, we'll start with the energy momentum tensor, the stuff that fills the universe. So remember, the interpretation of these co-moving coordinates is literal, like it's stuff that is co-moving with the expansion of the universe. And so I can describe the four velocity of the fluid as just something that sits there. So that's the four velocity of a parcel of fluid, something that's just totally co-moving. It just increases in time, but nothing else. Okay, and the implication of this is that if I look at the energy momentum tensor, it's going to be diagonal, okay, with rho on the first column, negative rho, and p on the others, or on the other entries, diagonal entries. So it's negative rho PPP. And now I can take this and I can plug it into my equation for the conservation of stress energy. So that has to equal zero. And this is really four equations because I've got four values that nu could take. So if I take that to be zero, just for convention, 0, 1, 2, 3 will mean something like t, x, y, z. So 0 means t. If I plug this in, then what you will find after just one line of algebra is that the time derivative of rho over rho is equal to negative 3 times 1 plus w, the time derivative of a over a. And that's a very easy equation to integrate. One finds that rho is equal to rho naught times a to the minus 3 1 plus w. So you can see that the equation of state parameter tells us how the density evolves with the scale factor. Okay, and some easy ones. So there's matter, okay, and here W is zero, so rho goes like a to the minus 3. You can picture that as just what would happen if I took a box and I made the volume of the box a little bit bigger. How would the density of non-interacting particles go? It would go like the volume of the box. Okay, so that's the A cubed. It's just the volume of the box. There's W equals a third. That's radiation. And for W equals a third, rho goes like A to the minus 4. So you can think of that. That's the box. But when I scale up the box, I also stretch out the wavelength of the photons. Okay? So there's a penalty of A cubed for making the box bigger and a penalty of A for stretching out the wavelength and thus decreasing the energy of the photons. So that's why it's A to the minus 4. And then there's W equals minus 1 for a cosmological constant. And in that case, rho for W equals minus 1, I get A to the 0 power. In other words, it's a constant. So a cosmological constant, of course, it doesn't dilute as the universe expands. And that's the strange property of dark energy. It's this weird stuff that doesn't dilute as the universe expands. Okay. And because I have fluids that dilute differently as the universe expands, and this is probably the last thing I have time to say, because I have a fluid, fluids that dilute differently, then we can understand the history of the universe in terms of densities. So if I were to plot a log-log plot, a nice feature of log-log plots is that power laws look like straight lines on a log-log plot, so that makes it look really nice. I have radiation that falls off pretty fast. I have matter that falls off a little bit less fast, so that if I go back far enough in time, radiation always wins. But then there's this point here where they cross, and then I can have the same density in radiation and matter. That's called matter-radiation equality. And then eventually I have lambda here, just a cosmological constant. And the universe can become dominated eventually. It always will become dominated by the cosmological constant because everything is diluting except for lambda. So lambda always wins. Okay, so I think that's where I'll stop today. And then tomorrow I just got a few more things to write down. We'll solve the Friedmann equation again, and then we can move on to discussing perturbation theory. So before I stop, are there any questions? Okay, so you know everything, and I will see you tomorrow morning. Oh, one thing before you go. So I do have a set of notes. I will try my best to be really diligent and tech up all of my notes. So I have the first installment, and I'll ask Dan to post that on the wiki right after class, so you could take a look at that. Okay, thanks.